live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. We have a powerful hour ahead. We're going to talk about vitamin C protecting against liver injury caused by MSG. We're going to take a look at a type of honey that you haven't heard before that is found to reduce harmful side effects of smoking, and how fruits and vegetables reaching an alarming state of nutrient depletion. How'd that happen? You would think that the more fruits and vegetables you consume, the healthier you'd be. Well, that's true if those fruits and vegetables are grown organically. If they're not, then it's not. Many people get MRIs and magnetic resonance imaging, but they always give you a little drink that you drink that can illuminate it. They say it's non-harmful. Wrong. The drug leaves toxic heavy metal residue in the brain. Also, your chronic abdominal pain may not be due to what you might think, like parasites or candida. Could be due to psychological dysfunction. And some patients in a vegetative state, where we think they're dead, they're brain dead, turns out they're not. Turns out that they're completely able to be aware of everything being said and done around them. They simply are not recording it in an electro way that the brain impulses are saying, this person's aware. So all those people whose lives were terminated, or all the discussions about the dying process, when someone's in a vegetative state, we should think twice about that, because they can be completely aware of what you're saying. My guest in the second part of our program today is Professor Lawrence Shope. Dr. Shope is a historian. He has a strong background in history, social science, international relations, and he's going to tell us about the Council on Foreign Relations. For a long time, over the internet and in magazine articles, the moment you said that the problem in the world today is in part due to bankers, you were considered a nut of no credibility. If you suggested that powerful people met together to plan agendas on how we should live our lives, what we should believe, what laws should be passed, you were considered a conspiratorial theorist. Well, what if what they were saying was true, but they were overly broad and general? We will have a professor on who has spent 50 years studying the Council on Foreign Relations. He is probably the most knowledgeable person in the world on the topic. Therefore, he does not come unprepared. He comes fully prepared to do what The Nation magazine, Mother Jones, and virtually the entire left has refused to do: be able to do an honest evaluation of its impact upon us and our lives. Also, we'll be talking about five of the biggest acts of corporate hypocrisy in America. We will also talk about a Concordia professor who received research to study vaccines, specifically the human papilloma vaccine. Got a $270,000 federal grant to study it. What did he say after he studied it? Wow. It's interesting. Radiation and cancer, risks of leukemia to nuclear workers. We were told, however, that all people working in a nuclear facility or living around it had no problem from the background radiation. They were all wrong. You put yourself at risk working in a nuclear facility or living near one. I'll give you the latest report on this. As you see, we have a lot to share. Plus, if time permits, there was a well-known politician who, during a Senate hearing, talked about the dangers of the corporate and government agenda of microchipping the entire population. Who was that person? What did they say? And why is it so relevant today? I'll play that clip from the congressional hearing. Also, guess who is the biggest protector of the international drug cartel in Mexico? The one that protects them, won't have them arrested, even supplies them with military type weapons. Our DEA is in the top drug dealing business, and the ATF is a top gun trafficker. Who's saying this? Well, an investigative reporting team for a television network. I'll play it. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. We know that we should be eating more fruits and vegetables. But what type of fruits and vegetables? Ideally, locally grown. They don't have to be certified organic. In fact, I will give you a brief overview of that. I taught organic farming in New York State at the Fertile Earth Farm for over 15 years. Thousands of people came. And what I showed them is that you don't have to be certified, because being certified means you're paying thousands of dollars, even if you just grow a small little piece that can be sold at a farmer's market. Then they have to inspect you. The inspection is something of a farce. They come, they take a look, and they might do a water sample. They'll check where your seeds come from, and so you show them your invoice, like seeds of chain, which is organic, and they may or may not take a sample. Well, I paid that year after year after year. Even if you don't grow anything, even if you don't sell anything, you still have to keep getting your license. So a lot of people simply can't afford it. But as long as you can show that you're not using pesticides, and if you are using something as a natural pesticide, like mixing garlic and apple cider vinegar into a dilution and spraying it on your leaves, which can kill aphids and bugs, fine. Now, for the people who are in the business of selling organic, then they should be able to show you the type of minerals used in the soil, the type of natural fertilizer in the soil that gives the fruit and vegetable a lot more mineral density. Now, every single study that I have seen shows that those who are grown organic have more minerals, more vitamins. In effect, they're healthier. So this is not a point of contention. For years it was, but now the science is out there and there are enough studies over a long enough period of time to show, yeah, let's get over this argument. This is like saying, well, we're not certain tobacco, you know, causes harm. Well, fine. But we are, and organic is more nutrient dense. That's the science. So what about people who don't care? They just want to have some vegetables or fruits. They could be eating or consuming genetically engineered food, or food that is monocrop, where the emphasis upon how many grapes can we grow, how many times we spray these grapes, 17 to 22 times a year, or these apples, about the same. And what if the soil's nutrient deficient? Too bad. What would the public know? Well, the trouble is the public won't know. This is the latest from PreventDisease.com. Quote, what if our food has been getting less and less nutritious? What if modern intensive farming methods, many of which solve malnutrition problems when they were first introduced, have affected the vitamin and mineral content of what we eat today? Could having a constant supply of varied produce and introducing genetically modified foods be compromising nature's goodness? Whether it be vegan, low carb, paleo, or any other diet, the quest for the healthiest method of eating shows no signs of abating. Yet all have considerable controversy. We know more than ever about what food does to the body and the importance of antioxidants, healthy fats, and low glycemic index foods. Then it gets into here about why, for example, a purple potato native to Peru has 2,800% more cancer-fighting anthocyanins than common russet potatoes. One species of apple has a staggering 10,000% more phytonutrients than Golden Delicious displayed in our supermarkets. And these are called superfoods. And where the people who forage for these wild foods healthier than we are today, They did not live nearly as long as we do, but growing evidence suggests they were much more likely to die from degenerative diseases, even the minority who lived 70 years or more. The primary cause of death for most adults, according to the anthropologist, was injury and infections. Most of this is based upon what's in the food that you're eating. Well, it comes down to this. If you're eating commercially grown, genetically engineered fruits and vegetables, the probability is you're not getting enough of your nutrients because the soil is depleted. So the answer is simple. Simply purchase certified organic. Locally grown is ideal. And if not organic, at least talk with the person that's selling it to you and ask them, how's it grown and how do they treat for insects? And people are, I trust most people, you know, and they're going to tell you. I found people to be very open and honest about it. Yeah, guy was growing watermelons. I saw him by the roadside. And I said, what do you use? He said, oh, we don't use much. He said, the only thing we use for about a month is we use some garlic and cayenne pepper, and we spray it underneath so that there isn't a rot, and that's it. Okay. Yeah, you look at the watermelons. They're not uniformly colored because on the part where they're on the ground, they're going to not have the same vibrancy, and it'll be discolored and a little bumpy. Fine. I have confidence buying that. I have confidence I'm buying something locally grown, A, that supports local farmer. I believe in that. That is fresh, a whole lot fresher than something that was grown 5,000 miles away, a lower carbon footprint, meaning the less a product has to travel from the ground to your plate, the less pollution is going to go into the environment from the truck or the airplane or the ship that brought it to you. So wherever possible, locally grown. And what's nice is a lot of the food co-ops in every town are looking for locally grown produce, and therefore that's important. Separately, eat spinach to grow strong. Yes, but there's much more. A new study shows that it also is good for osteoporosis. And of course, if you have osteoporosis, you may not know this, you're at a greater risk of having a heart attack and a stroke and breast cancer. That's right. 54 million U.S. adults are at risk of osteoporosis because they have low bone mass. That means that more than half of the U.S. adult population over 50 is at risk of breaking a bone and having a heart attack and having a stroke and getting cancer. So, how can we prevent that? Simple. You can get good minerals. And contrary to a Dr. Wallach, who told me, well, there's no way that any food's going to give you all the minerals you need. Well, sorry, Dr. Wallach, I would share a complete difference of opinion. You say you can only eat liver or eggs. Well, you may eat all the liver and eggs you want, but for those of us who are vegan and vitally healthy and have had all of our biochemistry done and who've studied the biochemistry of tens of thousands of people, the information is simply completely and totally at odds with our experiences and our science. Here's where you're going to get your minerals. Here's where you're going to get the minerals necessary to have strong bones that prevent you and protect you from osteoporosis, hence heart attack, stroke, and cancer. Green gives you the kale, spinach, Brussels sprouts. Why? Because you're getting vitamin K and calcium in highly absorbable form. The red from tomatoes, potassium, the red peppers, and vitamin C, yeah, and red in pink grapefruit, that's also good too. Orange, such as in oranges and yams, that gives you vitamin C, and pumpkins, that gives you potassium, necessary for strong bones. Yellow, such as in bananas and zucchini and lemons, that gives you lots of potassium that is essential for strong bones. Browns, such as in almonds and potatoes and walnuts, that gives you calcium and magnesium. Purple, as in potatoes and prunes, potassium and calcium. And also red and brown as in seaweed. In fact, dried seaweed contains more calcium and magnesium than milk. So you see, if you have a good plant-based diet, you're getting a wide variety of calcium, magnesium, potassium, vitamin K, vitamin D with some sunlight, vitamin C, bioflavonoids, and all that with manganese and boron. There's your minerals pulled together and give you extremely strong bones. And I'll tell you how important this is. I did a study in a health support group over 20 years ago. And in that health support group, we had about 400 people. It was about 90% women, and it was with 10% men, and they all had osteoporosis coming in. And we did bone mineral density tests at the beginning of the study and 3 months later at the end. The people were on a plant-based diet without supplementation, and yet we reversed demineralized bones and reversed osteoporosis. So easy to do, not difficult. And also for those of you who are getting MRIs. Now, in some cases, MRIs are necessary, but according to the latest research, you could also end up, because of this diagnostic tool, getting yourself some serious harm. And that's why it's important you pay attention. This harm also means that you could, for the loss of cognitive abilities, after only a few treatments from MRIs, because of toxic metals. In fact, there's one toxic metal in the MRI fluid, and it's known as, let me spell this for you, GAD, G-A-D, OL, O-L, N-M, I-N, I-U-M. And that is very toxic. A study by MD, PhD at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Robert McDonald, showed that the intravenous heavy metal that contrast the agents so they can look also is found in neural tissue. And this was published in the preview journal Radiology. So I would suggest that unless an MRI is absolutely necessary, you don't get it. And also be very careful because kidney patients, you get an MRI, you can end up with serious problems with your kidneys because kidneys can't secrete this toxic metal. So make sure you get chelation therapy if you ever get an MRI. And finally, according to Fukuoka University in Japan, people drinking more of the fizzy drinks have a greater risk of cardiac arrest, a heart attack. Quote, a major study of 800,000 Japanese individuals shows that consuming fizzy drinks can significantly increase your risk of heart disease and stroke. The study found that more people spent on fizzy beverages, the more likely they are to suffer cardiac arrest, that's a heart attack, outside of the hospital. And during cardiac arrest, the heart suddenly stops pumping blood around the body, and it's different from a heart attack in that during a myocardial infarction, the supply of blood to the heart is suddenly blocked, usually by a blood clot. Cardiac arrest renders an individual unconscious and stops their breathing. So you're more likely to die, all because of that carbonated beverage. Quote, our data on carbonated beverage consumption is based on expenditure in association with OHCA is not unusual. Findings do indicate that limiting consumption of carbonated beverages could be beneficial for health. You think? Yeah. If you mean you can help prevent a heart attack or a stroke, you bet. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
When Jesus was,
oh,
I'd like to welcome all of our listeners all over the world and all of the different stations carrying this program. By the way, there are times when, for whatever reason, a person cannot be by the land-based terrestrial station turning on the dial, or maybe not at a computer listening over the internet. And just this week, we had nearly 40,000 minutes per hour listening by people who couldn't catch it on a station. Here's the number that you call. Always have this with you. For any reason, you can't get it anywhere else, you can always hear this program live each day at noon Eastern Time over any portable listening device. Write this number down, 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. And that way, you always have that. Good. And we're at now 20 million. Whole lot of people listening over the telephone since we started. Number one in America, in North America, all PL radio stations. So it's a handy device. We're going to talk about the Council on Foreign Relations in about 10 minutes. Before we get there, thought you'd like to hear this. This is from Ian Fairley of Counterpunch. Quote, radiation and cancer. Risks of leukemia in nuclear workers more than double previous estimate. Quote, a powerful new study has been published in Lancet Hematology, which adds to this evidence. However, the study's findings are more important than the previous studies for several reasons. First, it provides strong evidence, as stated by the authors, of a, quote, dose-response relationship between cumulative, external, chronic, low dose exposures to radiation and leukemia, end quote. Second, its findings show the risk of leukemia among nuclear workers to be more than double the risk found in a previous study in 2005. And so this is it, the takeaway message. If you work in any nuclear facility or live by them, so you're exposed to the radiation emanating from those, we've been told not to be concerned. Because, well, it's low-level radiation. And this is showing it's the low-level radiation that's increasing leukemia. Quote, we assessed the effects of excluding people who had recorded neutron exposure. We showed a positive association with leukemia. So let me just make this very clear. The risk is greater when neutron-exposed workers are excluded. This is important because the 2005 study excluded workers exposed to neutrons. Therefore, the correct comparison is between the risks of non-neutron workers and neutron workers. So, who gave us this information? Well, it was 13 respected scientists from the CDC, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, Department of Health and Human Services, University of North Carolina, Drexel University School of Public Health, and Public Health England. So they're telling you there is no safe dose of radiation. Dr. Goffman, arguably the world's greatest authority on the impact of radiation on health, told me on this program that, Gary, one X-ray in your life will cause cancer inevitably later on in your life. And you think of all the women every year were encouraged from the teenage years on to get mammograms. Think of all the people who got fluoroscopic examinations in the 1950s. Think of all the people who go into a shoe store and put their feet into a little box and look at all the bones. Think of all the people who got chiropractic examinations and they had to have their, X-rays. Think of all the dental X-rays. Think of all the massive diagnostic x-rays, most of which are not needed, but there for defensive purposes. Even one is enough to cause cancer. Now, this is from Paul Buchheit of Alternet. The five biggest acts of corporate hypocrisy in America. One, corporations hoarding $2 trillion in profits, asking taxpayers to pay their employees' wages. Citizens for Tax Justice just reported that Fortune 500 companies are holding over $2.1 trillion in accumulated profits offshore for tax purposes, with estimated taxes due at $600 billion. Okay, well, that's only for those. How about individuals holding money that they have earned from corporations overseas? It's $26 to $31 trillion. Wouldn't it make sense, once and for all, to give a tax amnesty, to charge these people a flat 20% tax? We're looking at $6 trillion coming into the American Treasury if we did that. I've done the math. If we had one flat corporate income tax, I used to believe it had to be 20%, now it could be 15%, in which case you can eliminate the IRS, you can eliminate the Federal Reserve, there's no deductions, no one has to keep receipts for anything. It's just whatever you make, you pay a 15% tax on it. That would bring us an additional $1.2 trillion because no one can get out of it. And why is that important? Because of the game that is played. If you're rich, you don't pay taxes. If you're a rich corporation, you pay zero taxes. You even get subsidized back. Look at General Electric as an example of that. But what if you had no deductions? You simply paid 15%. Then everybody pays. No deductions, no accountants, no audits, nothing. Then what if we charged simply a 1% tax on every algorithm trade in Wall Street and a flat 10% tax on all of the new IPOs that are done and on all corporate takeovers. And that is one time when they do that. But daily on the others, that brings you an additional $300 billion a year that you're getting none of now. So just on those ways, we could bring $1.5 trillion that we don't have, and we're not doing it. It makes no sense. So, number two, mourning American lives, but not foreign lives. Quote, 2 days after President Obama expressed grief and anger about the Oregon school shootings, a hospital in Afghanistan was bombed by the United States, killing 22 people. Our government admitted its mistake, but we haven't apologized for funding Saudi Arabia's attacks in Yemen, which are killing hundreds of civilians and, by the way, have made over 21 million homeless or starving or have no water, causing one of the greatest humanitarian crises in world history. It even dwarfs what was done earlier in Afghanistan and Iraq combined. There you had about 6 million people who were made homeless or suffered, plus 1 million dead. Here, we're talking about 21 million. It's one of the poorest nations in the world. And Saudi Arabia is behind this, with the United States supplying it with all the weapons and strategic input, yet not a word of apology. And then we have caring about unborn children. Okay, but what about caring about living children? This is from me. The film Poverty Inc. is awakening a lot of people. And one of the scenes in there where I was traveling across America, and I filmed it over 5 years, shows how many kids in America are homeless who go to school each day, 1.6 million. But here's what no one is counting. How many lost their homes but had to go live now with relatives? It's called couch surfing. That's a different number. That's 13 million, and it's invisible. So, and how many of these kids that are in homes but don't have enough food, they're food insecure? 18 million. So let's add it up. You got at least 10 million kids who are homeless in the United States. Even if they're not on the streets, they're still not at home. They don't have a home. They're staying with someone or staying in a shelter or staying in a car. And then you got 18 million who are hungry. So that means you got almost around 27 million kids. And I don't see anything, zip, nothing being done about them by Democrats or Republicans, either one. And then number four, demanding self-reliance of people who can't find a living wage job. Quote, the Koch-funded Heritage Foundation proclaimed, helping the poor should mean promoting individual freedom through self-reliance. The Cato Institute added, quote, SNAP helps breed dependency and undermines the work ethic. What drivel? Facts. Nearly two-thirds of all working-age poor are actually working but not able to earn a living wage, forcing them to rely upon food stamps, which only provide $5 a day per person for meals. In addition, over 83% of all benefits going to low-income people are for the elderly and the disabled or the working households. Black families have the least opportunities and are the most maligned. The Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch, which now National Geographic is owned by Rupert Murdoch, so I'm canceling my subscription there, quote, blurted, too few blacks have taken advantage of the opportunities now available to them. Really? Mr. Murdoch and the other fascists over at Fox Fascist News Network, exactly how would you know? Are you there when they wake up in the morning in a home with less opportunity, where if they've been in prison, even for a non-aggressive offense like smoking marijuana, now they got a criminal record. They're seeking every place they can. Where they, if they are hired, they're hired at a lower wage. Exactly how would you know what's going on in someone else's mind, since you've never been by these people, ever, nor will you, nor the other people who live around the Heritage Foundation campus or the Cato Institute or all these other institutes and think tanks. I've never seen you go out to their neighborhoods to dine with them. You sure as hell weren't with my camera crew when we walked down the mean streets of America filming for 5 years. Didn't see any of you or your nice big NGOs. What crap. With maybe 1% of NGOs being legitimate, the rest of them are just spoiled, best and brightest dilettante asses. And if you doubt me, come to Haiti with me and see how much of the billions of dollars the Clinton Fraud Foundation people have given that actually helps the people of Haiti. It doesn't. There's a simple concept. Maybe this is new for Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly. Trickle down? No. No. When you got it at the top, you turn off the faucet. You don't want anything trickling down. And it doesn't. And so, and finally, turning away people who were displaced over our free trade. I'd like to know what free trade means. Do you mean taking 1.3 million American jobs when Clinton sold the Congress on the idea that, I'll do you a favor, you vote for this legislation, and then you had people going into from Mexico having to work 16-hour days to earn $7.40 a day, not enough to pay for food and schooling, and you said you provided them with jobs? Gee whiz. Would you work at that job? Would you have your daughters and sons work at that job? So why is your son or daughter, Mr. President, Mrs. President, because it's one and the same, why would you expect that any other child, any other parent, should expect less from the society towards them than what you would expect always more, opportunities, open doors, red carpets, for yours? If nothing else, we live in a world that is completely a hypocritical cesspool. Oh, and by the way, hey, how's it going out there in Hawaii? Hawaiian governor declares homelessness, quote, state of emergency. The state saw a 23% increase in its homeless population in the last year, quote, from Associated Press. Governor of Hawaii has declared a state of emergency to deal with the state's homelessness crisis just days after city and state officials cleared one of the nation's largest homeless encampments. The move will help the state speed up the process of building a homeless shelter for families, and the state is considering four possible sites. Making it, by the way, having the largest homeless rate of per population of any place in the United States or any of the 50 states. Well, the last time I was in Hawaii, kind of looked like Queens with a hill behind it. And I wouldn't go there. Oh, I forgot. You don't go to the place where everyone goes in Hawaii, which is just one overbuilt tourist attraction, blighting everything, unless you happen to get on the roof of one of the highest rises where you can see just about 2 inches of a famous rock sticking out from a cliff that is one of the tourist attractions. You got plenty of room to build. And how many shelters are you going to have to build? Why don't you simply do the right thing? Why don't you build a campus? Not a shelter. Shelter's not going to help. Build a campus. On that campus, you have a clinic, free medical clinic, quality care, and state-of-the-art. You have psychological, humanistic counseling for people who've been traumatized and their families and kids from being homeless. You have schooling, crafts. You have trades that are taught. You have people who may have been incarcerated and therefore having a hard time. And you have special needs education to get them an opportunity. Why not do that? So you have a campus where people feel they're part of a community. They're not just poor people being shoved into a building someplace. And why did it take you all these decades to realize you had a problem? You've had a problem for a long time. You just didn't want to deal with it. Now you got to. Now, before we go to our guest in a moment, I wanted to play you this. I wanted to play you a little piece. It's a short piece from a legislator at the time, a senator, who was very concerned about microchipping the population. Now that person hasn't said a word. Listen in.
The journey did not stop then, and it must not stop now, Judge. And we'll be faced with equally consequential decisions in the 21st century. Can a microscopic tag be implanted in a person's body to track his every movement? There's actual discussion about that. You will rule on that, mark my words, before your tenure is over. Can brain scans be used to determine whether a person is inclined toward criminality or violent behavior? You will rule on that. And, Judge, I need to know whether you will be a justice who believes that the constitutional journey must continue to speak to these consequential decisions, or that we've gone far enough in protecting against government intrusion.
Well, that was Joe Biden. Now he's vice president. Mr. Biden, where were you when it came to protecting us against the National Security Agency and the FISA laws being broken? You supported that. Where were you in supporting the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act? You were sitting in all those meetings. You supported it. Where were you when it came to attacking whistleblowers who were their only crime? Sorry, Mr. Sanders, you got it dead wrong on this one, showing some of your corporate allegiance, was when the whistleblowers, whether it was Drake or Manning or Snowden, they all had something in common. They were telling us about crimes committed by the government, and they did not profit from exposing those crimes. And then they became the enemy for exposing crimes against humanity. And you supported the attacks against them. Yet when you were a senator, you raised this in the hearings of now the head of the Supreme Court, Roberts. So today, if they want to microchip people, you wouldn't have a word to say about it. So much for integrity. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go over and say hello to a person standing by, Professor Lawrence Shope. I gave you his background earlier. He's here to talk about the geopolitical influence of the Council on Foreign Relations and U.S. policy in the global neoliberal economic system. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Gary.
Over the years, I've raised issues about the role of the Council on Foreign Relations in various contexts, but we've not done an interview solely focused upon them. And we hear of this large think tank that has great influence over many disciplines, and it is many publications that are influential and frequently get quoted by mainstream media. And its membership is a who's who of the global elite, leading politicians, academics, corporate and financial leaders, media moguls, journalists, and many more. Yet the Council on Foreign Relations manages to present itself as an independent, almost disinterested party to the apparatus of policy and decision-making that goes on in the halls of government behind closed doors of corporate conference rooms. So please summarize the origins of the original mission and purpose behind the creation of the Council, and from its outset, did the Council have any secret geopolitical or economic agenda it wanted to pursue, and if so, what would it have been? And finally, since the Council was created before the advent of the neoliberal economic strategy of Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, is its secret agenda any different today than when the Council was founded? The forum is yours.
Thank you. First, I think we do need to look at the Council's origins, and it saw itself as the inheritor of the British Empire. And this goes back to the First World War. Goes back to the First World War period, and the Council was the origins of the Council lie in the connection between the, I can hear something in the background, the connection between the, what was called the Inquiry, Woodrow Wilson's post-war planning effort during First World War, and an organization of businessmen based in New York called the Council on Foreign Relations. The Inquiry met with the British leaders at the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919. Inquiry, these were the post-war planners of Wilson. And they decided to set up a dual organization, an American and a British international affairs organization. And the American one didn't get off to a good start. The British one became the Chatham House, or the Royal Institute for International Affairs. The American version of it floundered, but they then met with the people that were running the Council on Foreign Relations, which was a businessman's organization that was trying to increase foreign business. They were based in New York, and it was big financiers and industrialists. And they met with the Inquiry people and decided to form an organization in 1921 called the Council on Foreign Relations. And within a short time, they had their magazine, Foreign Affairs. And it, since then, of course, it's been this same kind of connection, that is, professional people who are academics, thinking people, intellectuals, combined with the big businesses, especially the financiers, and having that as the center of the organization, that is, people of action and people of thought. And so from that period, 1921, they began to have a membership organization. Now, of course, a key thing of the Council, it's a very large membership organization. Now it has almost 5,000 members. Back then it was just a few hundred. And then another aspect of it is it's really, you could say, it's the world's most powerful think tank. It has the think tank as well as a membership organization. That's unique. Usually, it's one or the other. It's either the Heritage Foundation or the Brookings Institute, some think tank, or it's the NAACP, a membership organization. The Council brings those two together, and so that makes it unique and very powerful. It had as one of its first highlights in the Second World War period, when very early in the war, in fact, only 12 days after Hitler invaded Poland, the Council was meeting with the Department of State, talking about, let's set up some post-war planning organizations. Now, here the United States wasn't going to be in the war for over 2 years. Almost 3 years. And they were already talking about, planning for the post-war world. So they set up a group of planning bodies, five different planning bodies, study groups, that began to plan the economic, political, and geographical and other war aims and other aspects of the post-war world, and this was called the War Peace Studies. And they were very powerful in strategic planning in that period and since then. In the early period of the council, the dominant force was the Morgan Empire, the J.P. Morgan, the combined, you know, the industrial and financial aspects of the J.P. Morgan Empire, J.P. Morgan Bank. They were the ones that were the most powerful in the council in the early days. And then since the 1940s, 1950s, there was a shift into the Rockefeller Empire. So the first presidents and chairmen of the Council on Foreign Relations were from the J.P. Morgan group. And then since then, it's been people from the Rockefeller group that have been most prominent. David Rockefeller, for example, became a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in 1941. He became a director in 1949. He was the chairman from 1970 to 1985. And he still remains the honorary chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations today. He's almost 100 years old. Of course, he's the grandson of John D. Rockefeller. So the council has continued that strategic planning. They're the most powerful private organization in the United States and in the world. They've continued this strategic planning type of policy that they do with their think tank, and they were very instrumental in getting the United States into the Iraq War. They saw Iraq as a key to controlling so much of the world because Iraq is right in the center of the Middle East. It has a very large oil supply itself, and with U.S. bases in that area, in Iraq, they believed they would be able to control the Middle East oil, and of course China, Japan, and Western Europe, possible rivals to U.S. world power, those countries need that oil. So if the United States controlled that oil, then they would be able to control these other countries. So that was the geopolitical kind of stress there. So the council began to plan for this war, and in 2002, published a volume called Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. This was the Council on Foreign Relations publication, a book written by one of the fellows. They call their staff people fellows. One of their fellows, his name was Pollack, Kenneth Pollack. And he'd been a former CIA analyst and so on the National Security Council, and he was there at the council. He wrote this book, Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. He also wrote articles in Foreign Affairs. One of the articles in the magazine of the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs, had a heading, It's the Oil, Stupid, and that's a quote from the heading, and he was talking about the Persian Gulf and how important that oil was geopolitically to control the world. And this was the purpose of the to get into Iraq and to invade Iraq and overthrow the government. That was a statist kind of regime where the state controlled a lot of the economy. So if you overthrew that, then neoliberal type of, which is free enterprise for the big corporations, and of course they talk about the small state, but they want the big state for the big corporations and the rich. They want the small state for poor people, average people, working people. So the war aims of the United States and Iraq were oriented towards creating a neoliberal, free enterprise type of society where these multinational corporations could come into the country and then exploit the country. And it's reflected in the orders that J. Paul Bremer, of course, a Council on Foreign Relations member, he'd worked for the Kissinger Associates. Kissinger was very big in the Council on Foreign Relations for many years and was a director. He worked for Kissinger Associates. He became a council member early on. He's an upper-class type, and that's the favorite rich people, billionaires, multimillionaires, and upper-class people are the core of the Council on Foreign Relations. They have these other intellectuals as well, but the core is the and the leadership is oriented around these Wall Street financiers and so on. So anyway, Bremer, the Council on Foreign Relations person, was put in as the czar in Iraq, and he had a bunch of orders that he perpetrated or promulgated, and those orders were things like open up the Iraq economy to foreign investment, end the state control of the economy by cutting out the state industries. He had a number of other neoliberal-type programs like a flat tax that foreigners could control the banks, that you could have foreign investment in the banks before you could then. And, of course, foreign control of the oil fields, which ran into a lot of trouble because the people of Iraq didn't want that. And so there was a lot of problem with that part of Bremer's program. There was a lot of resistance. So when the Iraqi resistance began to become prominent in the war started in early 2003. The resistance was already underway by the middle of 2003, and then it became much more prominent in 2004, 2005. And then they brought in the hardline neo-fascists like Negroponte and David Petraeus, also both of them members of the Council on Foreign Relations, Petraeus with the military side and Negroponte with the political side as the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad, and they began a severe program of repression, barbarity, including torture and all kinds of war crimes. And it's interesting thing about the Council on Foreign Relations, their members, many of them are criminals in one way or the other, but they don't have to worry about their crimes because they're high enough up in the hierarchy, so they aren't prosecuted. David Rockefeller, for example, in his memoirs, admitted to bribing a Chinese ambassador in order to get favors for the Chase Manhattan Bank, which he was also chairman of, as well as chairman of the council at the time. This was in the early 1970s. And he had one of his assistants give a $50,000 bribe to the Chinese ambassador, the UN ambassador, and wrote it right in his memoirs. He wasn't afraid of prosecution at all. No problem there. He just put it in there, the memoirs. It's a very interesting little incident, how he got into China. So, and of course, we know that Bush and Cheney have admitted to war crimes in their memoirs and on television programs. They'd admitted to torture and war crimes. And, you know, Obama said, we have to leave that behind us. In effect, ratifying the Nazi principle of I was only following orders. So that's a good example of the Iraq War, which I have in my chapter 6. It's a full-length study of the decision-makers on the Iraq War and what the Iraq War was all about in terms of war aims and how it played out. And I found that 85% of the decision-makers on that war were members of the Council on Foreign Relations, including Condoleezza Rice, who got her start in the Council on Foreign Relations back in the 1980s. That's where she, at that time, I should back up and say the Council was a member, a male-only, men-only membership organization until 1970. Then they decided that they better try to get it more up-to-date, and so try to get a younger membership and a more diverse membership, including African-Americans, Latino people, and women. And so they were looking around for people that would fulfill their criteria. And, of course, Condoleezza Rice, an ambitious expert in Soviet studies, one of the Council's main themes in its earlier period was anti-Soviet, trying to overthrow the Soviet Union. That was one of their main themes. And so Condoleezza Rice fit in with that, and she was a young academic who specialized in that, and she was African-American. And they wanted more women, even though, you know, women are still a minority in the Council, but they've gradually tried to bring more women in as well as people of color. So Condoleezza Rice was one of the main decision makers, and she got her training in the Council on Foreign Relations and was a member of the Council from the 1980s and was a international fellow at the Council for a while.
Lawrence, so, I have one final question for this interview. Then I'd like to see if you'd make yourself available for our progressive commentary hour, just you and I alone, to discuss this in greater depth for a full hour. That, by the way, is the most listened-to program I do each week. And it's live Saturday, Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. In any case, for this hour, I'd like you to finish up by just addressing the following question. I have believed for a long time that much of the lack of progressive idealism implemented in policy or even discussed in rhetoric has to do with the neocons disguising themselves as liberals, disguising themselves as people who care, when in point of fact, you can find them in The Nation and Mother Jones and other who support Big Pharma. They support so many things that a true progressive wouldn't support. Take us through some of the so-called liberal institutions, including Pacifica, where you find that instead of being truly liberal, forget progressive, just truly liberal in the historical sense, that they have been able to co-opt or in some way influenced at one point credible institutions that today you wouldn't be able to distinguish them from, you know, some of the hard right-wing publications in their policies.
Maybe we should focus for this question on think tanks like the Brookings Institution. The Brookings Institution is very closely interlocked with the Council on Foreign Relations. So their personnel, their directors, their staff people as well as their policies are connected to this same network. I show throughout a whole chapter that there's a tremendous interlock between other think tanks, such as Brookings that has a liberal reputation, or Carnegie Endowment that has a liberal reputation. Those have a tremendous interlock with the Council on Foreign Relations, have many of the same policies. Robert Rubin, for example, is the current chair of the co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, and he has something called, he's been very active in something called the Hamilton Program at the Brookings Institution, which is how they try to couch conservative policies, neoconservative policies, into, make them sound like they're liberal policies, but actually they're anti-worker, anti-rank-and-file policies. So I think with the think tanks, you could think of a whole number of them, and I have in my Chapter 3 very detailed analyses of all these different think tanks, and they are connected in with the Council on Foreign Relations in this same kind of worldview, this neoliberal geopolitical worldview. Even organizations like the Nation magazine, which you've mentioned, have interlocks with the Council on Foreign Relations, not as prominent as some other magazines, of course, but the current editor, the publisher and editor, Catherine Vanderhoeven, is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and longstanding, and her other relatives, I think it's her father, William, is also, I think, with him, her father, and he's in the Council on Foreign Relations. So they have a few other directors. Francis Fitzgerald, at least in the past, have been members of the Council on Foreign Relations. So they have, and some of their funders, like Cora Weiss, has been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So the Council on Foreign Relations does have what you would call the liberal imperialist side, or the people that have a claim to being somewhat progressive, but they're members of this organization. One of them, I met Daniel Ellsberg at a meeting, and I noticed he was on the list of the Council on Foreign Relations. I asked him why he was a member, since he has dissented against many of these policies, and he said, well, I'd really like to go to their meetings. The Council's a membership organization. They have membership meetings, and they have a lot of speakers that are very important speakers. Anytime a big, important figure from another country, president, prime minister, foreign minister, etc., when they come to the United States, they almost always go to the Council on Foreign Relations because they realize that's the real power behind the scenes. We should go and talk to them. And so Ellsberg said he liked to go to the Council. He's in New York a lot. So he gets to the Council and is able to interact with these very important people, both in the domestic realm and in...
Okay. Lawrence, we're out of time for this interview. Look forward to doing a full-hour interview with you on the Council on Foreign Relations just to show the power of this group and who really is in it and how those decisions have impacted many of the events around the world that people are not aware of that connection. My guest, Professor Lawrence Shoup, S-H-O-U-P, he is the author of Wall Street's Think Tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. And his website is lawrenceshoup.com. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.